Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode number 102, recorded on Thursday, June 30th, 2011. Water World. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. 3, 2, 1. Welcome, everybody, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. This is episode 102. And as usual, it's 1 hour, one expert on one topic. And get ready to dig in and get dirty in the topic of the wonderful world of the oceans of our planet. We're talking about the state of our oceans with our guest, Andrew Thaler from the Duke University Marine Laboratory. But before we get started, of course, now we have the science headlines. What's up this week? Well, IBM successfully demonstrated a phase change memory cell that reads and writes 100 times faster than flash, stays reliable for millions of write cycles, and it's cheap to boot. The technology would allow computers and servers to boot instantaneously and significantly enhance the overall performance of IT systems. Not so bad for their 100th birthday. Moving on, how dependent are we on the electric grid for our sense of time? We will find out soon, thanks to a year-long experiment set to run by the North American Electric Reliability Commission that will allow more variation to occur in the frequency of our electric grid than the 60 hertz that we're used to. The study is meant to improve reliability, cost-effectiveness, and efficiency of the power grid, but may just wind up confusing our clocks. A new botnet known as TDL4 is 4.5 million computers strong and, say researchers, practically indestructible. Scary computer science. And astrophysicists announced the discovery of the brightest and most distant object in the universe, a quasar fed by a black hole that's nearly 2 billion times more massive than our sun, aged just 770 million years after the Big Bang. Hold on 1 second. There, I had an issue there. Back to the news. The Brazilian government announced the discovery of a new uncontacted tribe of about 200 indigenous people living in the Vale do Javari Reservation near the border of Peru, which was found using satellite maps and imagery. 1,060 new species were discovered in New Guinea from 1998 to 2008, including 218 new kinds of plants, of which around 100 are orchids, 580 invertebrates, 134 amphibians, 2 birds, 71 fish, including a rare 8-foot-long river shark, and 43 reptiles, and 12 mammals. New Guinea shelters 6 to 8% of the world's species. Volcanologist Terence Gerlach compiled the available estimates of CO2 emissions from all global volcanic activity on land and undersea and compared them with estimates for human emissions and found human activities emit about 135 times more CO2 than volcanoes do around the globe annually. Volcanoes got some catching up to do, obviously. In a study published in the journal Science, scientists point out that airplanes can cause localized snowfall from clouds that contain supercooled water droplets. The passage of a plane pressurizes the unfrozen drops, causing them to freeze and make the clouds snow. That does it for our science news for today. So on to our show. My guest today is Andrew Thaler. He's a graduate student working at the Duke University Marine Lab. Andrew studies population structure and connectivity of deep sea hydrothermal vent endemic invertebrates in the Western Pacific. according to his bio from his blog, his major interest is in how isolation and gene flow, not genes that you wear, but genes that are in the nucleus of your cells, how they affect populations separated by thousands of kilometers and how that compares with population structure at much smaller scales. And when not in the lab, he spends his time out on the water, usually swearing at his boat while simultaneously sacrificing some important tool to Poseidon in a desperate attempt to make the motor start. How many tools have you lost to the deep?
Probably six or seven nice wrenches.
They're probably all sitting there just underneath the berth where you keep your boat. You have to get some diving gear, go pick them up. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate the time you're taking to come join me here on the Science Hour.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
You're welcome. So let's get started. Big question of the hour, the state of the oceans. What state are the oceans in? How bad is it, really? The International Union for the Conservation of Nature had a release from a workshop they did recently that suggests that it's in pretty dire straits.
Yeah, well, this report that the IUCN did is probably among the most depressing ocean reports I've ever read. According to them, the ocean is not in very good shape at all. I think the major addition that this report makes to kind of the understanding of what's going on in the ocean is that the cumulative effect of all these different stressors are actually having more impact than we previously expected. A lot of our predictions about what would affect the ocean were based on models of kind of what happens when sea level rise affects the ocean, or what happens when overfishing affects the ocean. But these guys went through and took all the effects in totality to see what the cumulative effect of these multiple stressors were. And what it shows is that the worst case scenarios predicted from just one or two effects is actually, in general, an understatement. And some of our worst case scenarios are actually being surpassed. So the state of the ocean right now, not too good.
So, but looking at it, you think that the research that they've reviewed and the people they brought together are the most recent, the most pertinent research, and the people with the most expertise, are these people really the ones who should be saying this? Are we looking at this scientifically and saying, okay, who's looking at this? And is the consensus actually a reasonable consensus based on how they approached it?
I think this is a very good team that they brought together. There's a lot of the big names in sort of ocean conservation, a lot of big names mm-hmm. in kind of modeling the effects of what's happening to our ocean. I think one of the things that happens with reports like this is that they are almost necessarily sort of more evocative than what you would usually expect with scientific reports. And part of what happens is that because these reports come out, people change their behavior, and so these sort of grim predictions don't always come to pass. I know in the early 21st century, they came out with a report saying that all fisheries the world over were going to collapse by 2057. And that was based on kind of if fishing pressure continued at the level it was going at the time. And because that report came out, it got a lot of press. Managers of fisheries started to adjust their habits and sort of adapt to these reports. And there are actually currently some fisheries that are doing quite well and are quite sustainable that were previously slated to kind of be wiped out because people changed their fishing patterns and decided that the ocean was something we wanted to have functioning past 2057. So I think these reports are scary. I think the predictions they make, if we were to not change our behavior at all from this point forward, those predictions would probably come true or even actually be understatements of what's happening. But I think because there is a general awareness that the ocean is in dire straits, people will do things to correct these problems.
Yeah, the suggestions, I've got the PDF that's put out by IUCN. The suggestions that they make are immediate reduction in CO2 emissions, urgent actions to restore the structure and function of marine ecosystems, which include reduced fishing, closing fisheries, a number of other suggestions, proper and universal implementation of the precautionary principle, and urgent introduction by the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly of effective governance of the high seas. Now, all of these recommendations, I would imagine that they would be up for some argument. I mean, there are skeptics who say, you know, carbon dioxide emissions, it's not our problem. You know, we don't really, what do we humans have to do with it, really? You know, so is there enough science backing up what they're saying in this report?
I think for things like reducing CO2, there absolutely is enough science to back this up. We know that atmospheric CO2 levels have been increasing. People will claim that it's not anthropogenically caused, but that almost is aside from the fact, because if CO2 levels around the globe are increasing, that is going to have impact on the ocean, because CO2 is sequestered in the ocean. When CO2 is sequestered in the ocean, it increases the acidity of the ocean. And then organisms that rely on things like calcium carbonate and aragonite and calcite to build their hard structures can't function. And this includes things like coral reefs, which use aragonite to build their hard structure. Shellfish like mussels and clams need calcium carbonate. And a lot of experiments have been done with things like foraminifers and pteropods that both use calcium carbonate to build their hard skeletons, where pH reduction in pH, which is an increase in acidity of less than 0.24, results in their inability to build a shell. And I think we can all sort of accept that if shellfish can't build a shell, they can't survive. So things like atmospheric CO2, absolutely, the science is there. It's hard to argue with. It's a little more difficult to argue that we're at a point where we can actually reverse it. We can certainly reduce our impact as it stands now, but at some level, the CO2 is already in the atmosphere. It's already being sequestered in the ocean. We've almost passed a tipping point for some of these issues, and so we need to start looking at ways to mitigate the damage instead of ways to prevent it. And I think that was part of what they were getting at in this report, is that our timeline for changing things is shrinking rapidly. We'll very soon be at a tipping point where it will be more a question of response to environmental change than prevention of environmental change.
Right. In terms of prevention, when you look at the ocean and the ecosystems that are important within the ocean, what areas need to be highlighted? What ecosystems are particularly important for keeping things going?
I think the nursery grounds, so places where fish breed and spawn, such as coral reefs, mangroves. A lot of coastal ecosystems are both the most essential, because those provide the nursery ground for the next generation of fish, and the most in danger, because they are the ones that are the most affected by human activities. Mangroves, especially on the east coast of the U.S., we've torn out a lot of our mangroves and wetlands, and we can see the effect of this on our fisheries, because the fish that we rely on commercially for food and for people's jobs are disappearing because they don't have nursery grounds. Coral reefs as well, those provide substantial nursery grounds for a lot of fish. And they're also reservoirs of biodiversity in the world's ocean. One thing I think that was missing from the IUCN's report and from discussions of conservationists in general is we talk a lot about either preventing or correcting damage that we've done to already affected ecosystems. But there's very little talk of identifying ecosystems that haven't been impacted yet and preserving them before they're impacted. And that's part of what their emphasis on using the precautionary principle is. The precautionary principle is if you don't know what the effect of an action is, you don't take that action until you understand what the effects will be. Which is a bit of a tautology because you can't understand what the effects will be until you actually do something. But as a management tool, it's a useful framework to base management on.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are a lot of effects that you've already seen taking place, that we already know there are certain effects that occur to coral reefs or nursery ecosystems if certain things happen. And, you know, you can probably make best educated guesses at what might happen if certain actions are taken or not taken.
Right. And you can also do small scale experiments to discover what the effects will be before you do something large scale, like dumping a watershed's worth of agricultural waste into the Mississippi River.
Exactly. So in terms of what you're doing, the ecosystems you're working on are they quite different from, say, the nursery ecosystems that you're talking about? You work on hydrothermal vents and you know, what makes them stand out?
So the thing about hydrothermal vents is that, in general, the deep sea is usually thought of as kind of vast and empty. It's not really empty. There's huge amounts of biodiversity in the deep sea, but it's very, very low abundance. What's unique about hydrothermal vents is that they're ecosystems in the deep sea that have enormous abundance because they're supported not by photosynthesis, so they're independent of the sun, not totally independent because they still need O2, but the primary source of energy is not sunlight. And so these support very, very abundant communities of chemosynthetic organisms, which can utilize the reducing compounds that come out of the vents to produce energy, usually by either as chemoautotrophic bacteria or by harboring chemoautotrophic bacteria as endosymbionts inside larger organisms. So these ecosystems are built on a very kind of different foundation than what you think of in general when you think of an ecosystem. And hydrothermal vents aren't the only ecosystem that uses chemosynthesis as its foundation. You get methane seeps, which are often found on top of oil reserves because they're where methane hydrocarbons are leaching out of the seafloor. And you also get places like whale falls, which are very hydrocarbon rich. And whale falls when a dead whale sinks to the seafloor. And whales are pretty rich in hydrocarbons. They're especially the big oily whales like sperm whales. And so you get these.
They're a great food source, aren't they? And I know from a couple of years ago, there were some really interesting finds of some tube worms that had made these whale falls their homes.
Yeah, that would be those would be Osedax. Originally, there were two species found, but I think as of now, there's 30 or 40 different species of Osedax. That some are super specialists. They occur only on certain marine mammals, usually whales, sometimes seals, and some are more generalists. You can find them on fish bones. We've found them on pig bones before that have been discarded off the side of a boat. But what they do is they're very small worms, and they have this massive kind of root structure that burrows into the bone and sort of extracts hydrocarbons from the calcified matrix of the bone and then turns that into energy. And they have a really kind of strange ecology too, because they have dwarf male harems. So the females are these large worms that you see coming out of the tube. But then the males are these tiny, almost microscopic little things that live inside of the worm tube in a special organ that's just for the dwarf males. And so one female Osedax can have up to 200 dwarf males living inside their harem. And then they're totally dependent on stuff dying and falling to the seafloor. So they're very good at dispersing and finding new habitats. Hello?
Hello. Sorry, I was listening. My babysitter just got here and I passed off the baby.
So, all right.
So we are moving forward. I love the worms that burrow into the bone, the Osedax, like the stories of those animals is just, it's something that's out of a science fiction novel almost, or something that you can only find at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, they just inspired a lot of poetic license with the way people interpret them. I think the first time they were found, they were called the bone-eating worms. And then a couple years later, the headlines were talking about the bone-eating zombie worms from the deep. And I think the last headline I read, which is reporting, you know, there's like 40 different species, said bone-eating zombie worms from hell. So people have really kind of taken this idea of these, you know, osteotrophic worms and kind of run with it, which is great because they're good carriers for banner carriers for deep sea biodiversity. They're these fascinating animals that until about 2001, no one had any idea they existed.
Yeah. Now, thinking about the deep sea, you know, most people, like you were saying, the chemoautotrophs, they don't use light. They don't photosynthesize. It's dark down at the bottom of the ocean. You know, most people think of the bottom of the ocean as this very dead place. How much different from, I mean, how dead is it? I mean, how widespread are these chemoautotrophs? Or do you only, or even the organisms that feed off of whale falls or other organic matter that falls from above to the bottom of the ocean to be fed upon? Can you give us some kind of a characterization of the life that's down there?
So at hydrothermal vents, if you were to look at a map of the world with all the sort of tectonic plates, all of those kind of boundaries where two tectonic plates are colliding, you'll find hydrothermal vents. They're common, but they're not super abundant. The deep sea, the deep benthos, is much, much, much larger than just the area where the hydrothermal vents are. But hydrothermal vents, they're not rare, but they're difficult to find, and you won't really see them unless you're looking for them. With regard to the diversity of sort of the deep benthos, which is sort of just sediment and rock across the deep sea, the diversity is huge, but it's mostly microscopic. So you really have to be looking for it to see it. And that's why things like the Challenger expedition, which was the first major oceanographic expedition in the 19th century, it went out and it plumbed the depths of the deep sea and it brought up tons and tons of sediment from across the world. And they concluded there wasn't very much life down there because it was mostly microscopic and they lacked the tools to really see it. We now know that it's actually very abundant and diversity is very, very high in the deep sea.
I think that's fascinating. For the hydrothermal vents, you say that they're hard to find and you don't really find them unless you're looking for them. How much of an impact do they have on the oceans around them? Is there an estimate of how they affect the oceans at this point in time?
So locally, they dramatically change the ecosystem where they are, or the background ecosystem where they are, because they're releasing these huge plumes of heavy metal laden superheated water. So locally, the hydrothermal vent will dominate the landscape. Globally, I think I've seen estimates where the entire volume of the ocean filters through hydrothermal vents over the course of, I want to say 1,000 years, but it might be 12,000 years. It was some number that seems very large, but in geologic timescale is not very large. So
right.
Seawater goes through hydrothermal vents. And so they do have an effect on the chemistry of the ocean.
Okay. And for the hydrothermal vents that you study, do you study all kinds of hydrothermal vents, only hot black smokers or the lower temperature vents? And what kind of differences do you find in the vents themselves?
So usually I study black smokers primarily, but they sort of all come together because it's sort of the distance. The vents occur in fields, and however close they are to the heat source kind of dictates how hot the water is coming out. So you'll usually have a black smoker with very hot water coming out that's somewhere around 300, 350 C. But you'll have diffuse flow around the smoker, and those will come out at 60 or 70 or 80 degrees C. And so at the really thermally tolerant organisms will be around the black smoker. And then you get organisms that prefer the diffuse flow, like certain species of mussels that sit sort of right on the effluent as it's coming out in the diffuse flow vents. So really, when you look at vents, you're kind of looking at all of them together when you go down there.
How do you go down? What is the what's your method of study? How do you view them?
So I use ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, and they're giant robots we've built to go out into the deep sea. Kind of the romantic notion is that we all go down in Alvin and these big, really kind of fancy submersibles, and that would be great. I haven't had the opportunity to go on Alvin yet, but if any deep sea biologists are watching and have a cruise coming up, I'd love to go. But the ROVs really, they really open up the deep sea because you get multiple cameras. You can have, if you go down in the Alvin or any of the other submersibles, you can have two or three people total. With the ROVs, you can have 40 people in a command room watching the screens and watching for things. So it's a different experience than the submersibles, but it's a very valuable one. And it's sort of like playing a video game sometimes because you get to steer it with a joystick and you have a robotic arm that's manipulated by sort of a scale model of the arm that's sitting next to you that you move around.
That sounds really neat. How's the visibility? Is it basically like you're just looking out at the whatever the camera gives you, and do you have one view? Do you have multiple views? How are you visualizing it?
There's usually multiple cameras mounted on the ROV. Sometimes you get a stereo camera or two. The visibility is as good as your lights are. There's not a lot of suspended particulate matter, so however bright your lights are how far you can see.
And how does you say there's not a lot of suspended particulate matter. When you're going down and you're maybe taking samples or, you know, looking around, how much do you disturb the environment, and does what you're doing actually cause most of the difficulties that you have to conquer?
If your ROV hits the bottom, that's the biggest problem, because then you throw up huge, huge plumes of dust and you have to wait for it all to settle. As far as disturbance, it's as disruptive as the sampling method you use. There are some sampling methods that sort of put a giant grab bag over the vent that cinches tight at the bottom and pulls it up, and that kind of pulls up everything off the vent. You can use the robotic arm and pick things off one by one. In general, the impact is probably fairly small. The deep sea biologists and ecologists and chemists and oceanographers and geologists came up with a series of guidelines for the conduct of responsible research at hydrothermal vents, which was it was a pretty impressive meeting where a lot of the international deep sea community came together and agreed on these guidelines to sort of minimize the damage we caused to hydrothermal vents. So I think probably in the long term the damage is fairly minimal. Occasionally they'll sample an entire vent chimney. The geologists will take a whole chimney up to analyze it, and obviously that's going to disrupt sort of the animals that live on that chimney.
Yeah, but maybe not much further than that chimney itself.
Right. And these ecosystems are very dynamic on their own. You can think of a hydrothermal vent almost like an underwater volcano. It's not. It's more like a geyser, but it's that level of sort of violent disturbance. So it's, you know, they're on fault lines. They're tectonically active. There's earthquakes quite frequently. There's eruptions quite frequently. These ecosystems have evolved to deal with a very high level of disturbance. And so they can handle a large amount of impact before they start really, really being affected by it. But when you think of a hydrothermal vent ecosystem, you think their lifeline at that specific vent is usually on the scale of 10 to 100 years.
I'm going to take this opportunity to take a quick word from our sponsor. So stick with me, Andrew, and we'll come back to the conversation in just a minute. I'm really interested in the hydrothermal vent ecology of some more very, very important questions to ask you. So everybody, this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, your PC, your iPad. They have an iPad app. You can watch on your iPhone and Android phones as well. And if you have gaming consoles like the Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. Those are inexpensive and pretty easy to use. You have all sorts of options in front of you for using Netflix. And with Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly. Using any of these devices, you can begin watching a movie or a show on one device and then finish on a different one. Whichever ways you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want. And you can cancel at any time. So try Netflix today for 30 days completely free. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. That's Netflix, netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Now back to the Science Hour. We're speaking with Andrew Thaler from Duke University's Marine Lab about the state of the ocean and digging into hydrothermal vents, which is the area of his specialization. Now, Andrew, you're talking about how these vents are they're used to disturbance, and that they're volcanic areas naturally very disturbed, probably on a significant basis. What about mining, in terms of what we want to do, how we want to treat the oceans? You say that you have scientific standards for studying these vents. People are talking about mining operations at the hydrothermal vents because there are lots of metals that we'd like to get at.
Yeah, so hydrothermal vents are very rich in a lot of precious metals. I actually have a piece of a vent with me here. This would be the kind of top where the vent fluid's coming out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can quite see it, but I'll hold it up and hopefully you can see it's kind of it's very shiny on the inside.
Yeah.
It's rich in nickel and copper and iron and gold and a lot of other precious metals. So in terms of ore, it's very rich ore, which is bad news for the vents, because anytime we find a place that's very rich in ore, we want to get at the ore. So there are
dope. Did he lock up? Yes, he locked up. We'll
yes,
have to call.
He did.
We'll have. I think there was too much movement. Maybe the bandwidth got overloaded. So I hope that he will.
He tried to put too much movement in the tubes.
Don't put so much movement in the tubes. You move too much, you break the tubes. So say we all. When he comes back, I want to find out. He said so. And I was interested. I was very interested. Yeah, it sounds like there's pretty much everything in those vents that we would want to mine. It definitely sounds. Come back. This is, we might retitle this as Disrupted Oceans. Disrupted Podcast.
Well, he has dropped offline.
Disrupted tubes.
So I think he's going to be a minute before he returns.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll be able to get him to get back to what he was saying, because it was quite interesting.
If only you had waited a few more minutes on that Netflix ad.
I know. That would have been perfect timing, right? Perfect timing. For a cut, chop. Shiny, happy people holding hands. There's that ringing again.
Yeah, I think it's actually forwarding his Skype to his cell phone.
There we go. What are people saying? Big Mining is trying to silence him. Right. They've cut off his T1. They've cut off the T1 connection to the island that he's on.
Yeah.
Have I been playing with Hangouts on Google Plus? Not yet. I haven't been doing a lot of Google Plusing, just a little bit of Google Plusing, not a lot today because I'm getting ready for the shows that I do today and taking care of my child. And people who were wondering about the babysitter situation, I had a babysitter, but then she got a cold and called me and said she couldn't come because she had a cold because we don't want to give Kai a cold, right? So I had to scramble and try and find another babysitter. And the wonderful Lux, friend of mine, she said she could come, but she had, she was doing therapy sessions. She's a therapist. She's doing therapy sessions at the hospital until 4. So then she had to get a cab and get here. And yeah, so it was just a difficult babysitter day because everybody I would normally have as a babysitter is away in another country. Bali, Mexico. I don't know what other countries. Yeah, wow. I know.
Hello.
Yay, you're back.
I'm sort of back. I'm on my phone now.
That we can keep going if this works.
All right, I guess I better find
no
a picture.
No video, but I cannot.
People will be like, what? When in the final edited version, people will say, what just happened to the audio? They had a sudden change.
Well, my computer comes back to life, I'll switch over.
Yeah. I was saying while you were gone that we should just retitle this show Disrupted Tubes.
I'm actually simulating a dynamic ecosystem.
Exactly. We're adapting, we're taking care, rebuilding. It's all good. Should I wait for you to grab a picture, Colin?
I don't actually have a picture phone, but it looks like my computer might return to life in about 2 minutes.
All right. If not, I have a flattering picture of you in a cowboy hat and a flannel shirt that we'll put up on the screen.
I love that picture.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm just going to let my computer settle down this time before I try to start everything.
Understood. Definitely understood. Yeah. Technical difficulties. Let's see. So in the meantime, I'll just... I guess should we... I'm wondering if it'd be worth it just to go ahead or if you're going to be hanging up and then calling back on your computer.
I think I should be going here in a... It looks like it's
just wait.
Just about settled. Let me make sure Skype and the webcam can start.
Okay. Yes. You have to soothe the computer.
Yeah.
Pet it. It likes to have nice pets.
Yeah.
Pet the computer. Yeah. Tell it it's pretty.
Yeah, my last computer had an unfortunate run-in with a machete, so I thought the threat would work, but it doesn't seem to.
That sounds like a story.
Yeah, well, it's actually not that exciting a story. I got really frustrated with my computer, so I had my office mate chuck it at me while I swung a machete at it.
That's a very office space way to deal with a computer. Just I've got a machete and I know how to use it. Let's let's take out the computer. It's good. I like it.
It worked. Well, it didn't work after that, but the machete worked.
You have a computer in multiple pieces.
just two big ones.
That must have been a sharp machete. That's some serious steel. Nice.
Oh, yeah. It was one of those tough books, too.
That could be an advertisement for machetes. This machete can take down a tough book.
Yeah. I think I'm running again, so I'm going to hang up and call you back on my laptop.
Okay, great.
All right.
Panoramic. That's not a knife. This is a knife. Yeah.
I see you've played knifey spoony before.
Knife, that's a spoon. Yeah, I should just not try and fake an Australian accent. Really. Really. Just not even try.
I'd like to hear that.
It's probably entertaining for how terrible it is. Working at Twit with these people who have been in broadcasting for years, Leo, Tom, they can all mimic different accents very, very well. And I'm kind of jealous of that because I can't. Not so good. Huh. It just comes off sounding bad. Oh, except for my Russian accent. We do the Russian accent here. That's all. Okay, let's get going. Back to the show. We will complete the show. We will complete the conversation. Yes. Okay, so we were talking about mining. You had just shown your the piece of the chimney, talked about what was in it, the idea of mining, and I heard so, and then it went blank.
Right, so a lot of countries are looking into the potential for mining their hydrothermal vents. Japan and China have a lot of hydrothermal vents off the coastline. Papua New Guinea has hydrothermal vents, and now my webcam's gone. Papua New Guinea has hydrothermal vents within its territorial seas. I know Fiji and Tonga have them as well. And this is a very valuable resource. It's a little less. People aren't looking into the international water yet because the International Seabed Authority has jurisdiction in international seas, and so people aren't quite looking there yet because there's a lot of regulations involving where the money goes when you extract the ore in international waters. There was in the 80s, there was a big furor over the potential to mine manganese nodules on the seafloor. Manganese nodules, they sort of just form on the seafloor, and they're very—I don't actually know exactly how they form, but they're not uncommon. And so in the 80s, people were all excited about mining manganese nodules, but then kind of the market fell out for manganese. It proved to be very technologically complicated to go out and get them for very little reward. So that sort of fell by the wayside. But those manganese nodules was kind of the impetus for forming an international seabed authority that would protect mineral resources on the seafloor.
When it comes to mining at currently, technologies have gotten better, but when the mining happens, is it pretty similar to the mining that you see on the surface of the land that's out of the water, where it's just, it kind of decimates an area?
So the problem with that is that no one's actually done the mining yet. So we don't know exactly what it would look like. What we do know is that the communities that live on hydrothermal vents are living on the valuable ore. So it will almost certainly wipe out those communities. Whether or not that will have a more of an impact than, say, the natural dynamic processes that happen at vents, I don't think anyone really knows whether or not that will be the case. I can certainly imagine that if it becomes an industry that is wholesale mining across a large chunk of the seafloor, then it will probably have an impact. But I don't know what small-scale mining will do.
Right. In terms of the ecosystems of the vents themselves, you're interested in invertebrates, but there are invertebrates, microbial life that you were talking about. Do organisms stay within one vent area, or do they catch a ride on currents and end up populating different vents? Do they jump from vent to vent and actually have a flow from the different populations between populations?
So vents are fairly well connected. There's some pretty definite biogeographic regions. So vents in the Western Pacific are pretty well connected. Vents on the East Pacific Rise, which is off California, and it's the ridge line that's formed at the same fault that forms the San Andreas Fault. So there's a string of hydrothermal vents that go down from the Gulf of California, and those are pretty well connected. Vents in the Atlantic are pretty well connected to each other. But then these different biogeographic provinces, we're not quite sure how they're connected globally across the whole ocean. So the organisms that live there, The actual organisms, for the most part, don't move from vent to vent. What they do is they broadcast their larvae, which then settle at new vent sites. There are some shrimp and crabs and squat lobsters, which are cool little sort of crab, sort of lobster-looking things. They made the news a while ago when someone discovered them. They called it the Yeti crab, this kind of weird lobster-looking thing with these big furry arms and everything. Which are really cute to look at. And so, again, another nice standard bearer for the deep sea. But so there are some animals that as adults can move between vents. But most of the habitat-building organisms, the tube worms, the big snails, the stuff that is deriving its energy from the vents and then using that energy to build biomass, they're pretty well, as adults, stuck wherever they are.
Okay, so they're probably not moving around, unlike the whales, which now, because of the clearing of the Northwest Passage, whales are free to move between the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans once again, where populations have been separated. So maybe they can hitch a ride. The larvae can hitch a ride with the whales.
Yeah, well, maybe.
I know. I'm stretching. I'm reaching here.
The larvae are pretty well dependent on the currents. And it might be a little, well, it probably won't be too cold for them to pass through the Northwest Passage. But, I mean, in terms of larval connectivity, we've had the Panama Canal open for 100 years. And the strait between South America and Antarctica, whose name shockingly escapes me, the Drake Passage has been opened. So, I mean, the oceans, there aren't any, like, absolute barriers to dispersal in the oceans. They're just sort of the current regimes and the way that organisms move through the oceans are what limits them to their specific habitats.
Do you think, aside from mining, the hydrothermal vent ecosystems, are there any major threats to those ecosystems, or is mining and human destruction of those ecosystems probably the greatest threat?
I think the biggest threat vents will face is probably going to be mining. I can see in the future there's a potential for bioprospecting to become an issue, but I don't see it happening at the same magnitude for the simple reason that bioprospecting, you want the organisms alive, and you're not taking very many of them. For people who aren't familiar, bioprospecting is going into highly diverse ecosystems and looking for specific genes or proteins that might have pharmaceutical or industrial properties.
But for other ecosystems, we're looking at a number of different threats. For you personally, Andrew, what got you interested in delving into the oceans, specifically hydrothermal vents, but just, you know, more generally studying the oceans as your science?
I was kind of one of those kids who sort of said I want to be a marine biologist when I was 6 and never really grew out of it. I had a ton of fish tanks growing up, literally a ton of fish tanks. My parents made me get rid of them when the floor of my room started bowing in and the plaster on the ceiling in the room below me started to crack because the weight of the fish tanks was causing our house to collapse. So I've always loved the ocean. I've always loved marine life. I had a lot of fantastic mentors growing up who got me internships and volunteer positions and eventually a job at the National Aquarium in Baltimore raising seahorses. So that was sort of my introduction to the science side of marine science. And I've been kind of running with it ever since. For the deep sea and hydrothermal vents, I think James Cameron probably had more of an influence on my life than I'd really be comfortable admitting.
Too late. You just admitted it.
I know. Yeah. I know. But
too late.
I watched The Abyss growing up. I thought it was an
amazing that movie.
My sister was obsessed with Titanic for the summer that everyone was obsessed with Titanic. So I had to sit through that a few dozen times, and the movie itself wasn't that great, but I really, really loved all the submersible scenes at the end. And then just sort of kind of the romance of having the last great unexplored place in the world. And it's the biggest ecosystem on the planet, and it's almost completely unexplored. So just the potential for new discoveries and excitement and adventure has always been there.
Do you think that people like Craig Venter are doing good work for expanding our understanding of the oceans? Is that one of the, and also for getting people interested in the oceans?
I have mixed feelings about things like the Venter Project. I think the science is great. The stuff they're doing with unlocking sort of this rare and invisible biosphere around the world is phenomenal. I know a lot of South American countries had issues with the Venter program because they were going through and essentially taking genetic resources out of a country without sort of asking permission or kind of getting clearance or involving the country. And because of that, a lot of countries have sort of locked up their biological resources. If you go to Brazil, you can't take if you do scientific sampling in Brazil, you can't take biological material out of Brazil. You can take I do genetics, so I know you can take amplified PCR product, but you can't take the original DNA. so things like that, you know, the unanticipated consequences of kind of these brilliant, gigantic global exploration programs.
Yeah, I would just say I hadn't heard that side of it. You know, I've just heard the very positive, you know, the work that's coming out of it, the acclaim that they've been getting.
Yeah, and it is very positive. I mean, they've done spectacular work, but I think one of the things you always have to be aware of when you're doing kind of international work or scientific work in other countries is that you should always involve scientists and stakeholders from the countries you're working in. We're an international community. Scientists have pretty high regard in most countries. People are usually very excited to have science done in their backyard. But it's important to always involve the people who live where you're doing the work. And that even includes, like, in the U.S. Like, we do a lot of community outreach for the programs we do locally, because if people are involved in the science, they're more committed to it, and they're more excited about it. So it's just – it's important when you're doing international work to involve the people where you're working.
Yeah.
And not just swoop in, take data, and swoop out.
Yeah. We're from America. We're taking
Hello?
Your animals. Yes. What you're saying about the community aspects of it and getting into the community, it just seems to me that ocean work is inherently much more international than a lot of other sciences, even ecological science that takes place within a country's borders. It just seems we have our 200-mile border out, you know, for water rights off the coasts of countries, but things go in and out of that constantly, and everything in the oceans, I mean, they're all connected.
Yeah, absolutely. The oceans are one gigantic ecosystem, and the organisms that live there don't care about borders or national boundaries or political status. So, yeah, I mean, kind of by nature, oceanographic research has to be an international endeavor.
For what you're working on and how you communicate, tell me what got you interested in starting to blog and communicate your science to the public?
It was actually Kevin Zelnio and the guys at Deep Sea News who got me into blogging. Kevin worked in our lab for a while and convinced me to start a blog. I had done like little blogs before, but never anything that was designed for sort of a broader appeal. But I liked the ability to sort of communicate science to anyone who was interested, and it was really fun. And I got a lot of feedback from a lot of people I respected, and so I kept going with it. And now we've built a nice little community on Southern Fried Science that's international and informed and excited to discuss science.
Have you run into any problems with your blogging and the science that you're working on? I know that's occasionally universities, different academic institutions have issues with graduate students and their researchers blogging. Has that occurred in your experience?
Yes and no. some of the research I do is kind of embargoed until publication, so I just can't talk about it. And that's, you know, to protect the fact that these are big international teams and there's a lot of different things going on. And someone doesn't want to suddenly be surprised that all their data is being talked about, you know, in the U.S. when they're still kind of processing it in France. So a lot of the stuff that I do directly, I don't talk about on my blog. I talk about things kind of peripheral to it. I do population genetics. So I talk a lot about population genetics theory and sort of how connectivity in the ocean functions. And then I talk about a lot of the side projects I have going on. But yeah, there are definitely barriers to directly communicating your science. Some of them are good. Some of them, you know, I'd rather they weren't there, but they're there. So we just live with them.
Right. I was looking at your blog recently, and you started doing what seemed to be trading cards, little cartoons and trading cards with your invertebrates as main characters. What got that started?
So I discovered that there's definitely a niche for web comics about hydrothermal vent endemic invertebrates. Really what happened was I found that I was doing a ton of writing for my own thesis work, and I started the blog in part, you know, to have an outlet to do other creative stuff. And if I'm working on three different manuscripts and a technical report, then the last thing I want to do in my free time is write. So I decided I'd start doing some cartoons for a little bit. And that's been fun. I don't know how long they'll persist, but they'll certainly appear again.
Do you think of them more as cartoons for other marine scientists who might get the joke or be in on the joke, or do you think of them as educational tools?
I think I did. The first few I did were definitely supposed to be educational, but I think that rapidly devolved into just in-jokes very quickly.
Can you give me an example of an in-joke for a marine invertebrate ecologist?
So I think in the very last, the one that you just had up there, it was the whole thing was just a trophic ecology punchline where the hydrothermal vent crab was eating pineapples just to screw up the trophic ecologists.
Pineapples? You don't eat pineapples? Exactly.
I do know many trophic ecologists that have found bizarre things in their samples that just don't make any sense. And the only thing that they can come up with is the animals are trying to mess with them.
I agree with that. I think, you know, any animals that we try and study, it's all a joke on us, all a joke on the researchers, on the poor humans. And if we get any data from them whatsoever, it's because they've taken pity on us.
Science by pity. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of, you know, a wrap up message for the state of the oceans. We've been talking a lot about the state of the oceans in general, different ecosystems, your hydrothermal vents, ecosystems that you study. There's still concern for the oceans in general, the fisheries, the ecosystems that support these, the fisheries at the base level that support human populations in the end. Is there a positive spin? Do you think that we can do anything right? And if so, what can people take home and maybe apply to their own lives?
I think that there are a lot of positive messages in ocean conservation. If you look at Monterey Bay, for the most of the 20th century, it was basically a wasteland. You know, that was Steinbeck's Cannery Row and everything. And it was a dumping ground for fish waste, for cannery byproducts. It was massively overfished throughout most of the 20th century. And that was the place where people figured out the cascade effect, where you take out one organism and the whole rest of the ecosystem crashed. So, I mean, someone who was looking at Monterey Bay in 1975 would have written it off and said, well, that's, you know, it could never recover. It's been totally destroyed. Now, if you look at Monterey Bay, it's one of the most beautiful and diverse ecosystems on the California coast. And that's because of conservation efforts by a few very dedicated and very forward-thinking conservationists. So I think there are messages of hope in the ocean. It's not all doom and gloom. I think we need to be aware of the fact that our actions, for the most part, are going to have a negative effect on the ocean. But we can minimize those effects and, in some cases, reverse what we've done. So yeah, no, I'm a fatal optimist. I think things are changing, and things are always going to be changing, and the mere existence of the human race is going to profoundly alter the ecosystem. But I also think the planet's a lot tougher than we are, and I think in the end, as long as we're aware of what we do and try as hard as we can to minimize our damage, the world can adapt, and we will always have an ocean. We just might not always recognize it.
Right. It might not always be the same ocean. And if you ever look at the surface of the ocean, it's never the same surface twice. It's always changing. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for joining me today. I apologize for some of the disruptions that we had during the hour, but we got through it. We made it through the show, and I think it was a really interesting conversation. I loved finding out about the hydrothermal vents that you study, and I'll be keeping an eye out to find out more about the population genetics and the nitty gritty of the information, what's going on at the bottom of our seas.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Anybody else who's interested in information regarding the work that Andrew does, the population genetic stuff, the comic strips that he's been producing, you can find him at southernfriedscience.com. And he and a couple of other graduate student bloggers, marine science bloggers there, put out all sorts of interesting information related to marine science, sharks. There's been a lot of shark stuff up recently, so that's pretty cool stuff, especially for the summertime. And Andrew posts consistently interesting information, so be sure to check out their blog for more information. That's it for the Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki, and next week we're going to be talking about more science. That's right, more science. Get ready. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter, Facebook, here on the Twit Network. Just Google me, Dr. Kiki. I'm out there. And you can subscribe to this show, Dr. Kiki Science Hour, either by using iTunes, or you can go to our website, twit.tv/Kiki. You can find past episodes there. You can subscribe in a number of different formats to whatever format you choose. Additionally, This Week in Science allows you more science news. If you liked the science headlines at the beginning of the show, you can find a little bit more science conversation about those headlines and more stories, even more stories, every Thursday night here on the Twit Network at 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, and that's twist.org. So that's it. I'm done. This has been the Science Hour, and if nothing else, I do hope that this hour has made your world a whole lot more interesting. Thanks for watching.